between bites. We're gonna get started. If you wanna have a seat or post up, wherever you're comfortable. All right. Well, thank you guys all for coming. This is our fourth installment of Between Bites. So we're very excited about this venue and our readers. I just kind of wanted to ask, raise your hand if you have been to a Between Bites before. All right, you guys. What if you've been to two of them? Keep your hand up. Three? Anyone been to all four? Bill Schreiber. Nice. Thank you guys. We just love your support that you guys keep coming to these events. They're so much fun to do. We want to also thank everyone here at Homestead who helped make this possible, especially Dave Andrews. I don't know where he is, in the back. We also want to thank our sponsors tonight. We have Dark Horse Wines again and the Craft House Cocktails in the corner. A couple other people who are helping out tonight, Erica Kubik, who has volunteers to help work our door, and Bert Ganzen, who's going to be photographing us tonight. Thanks, Bert. and Tim Pickett, the president of Sound and Lighting Designs, who donated the mic and the speakers tonight.
So for every Between Bites event, the hosting chef or restaurant gets to pick the charity that will benefit from the ticket sales, and Homestead selected a charity called UN86. And we'll actually welcome a representative at the break who will talk a little bit about their mission. So tonight, half of the proceeds will actually benefit the scholarship fund for Victoria McManus. She was a former employee at Westtown Bakery and Diner and was actually tragically murdered by her boyfriend in May. The scholarship was set up by Victoria's parents in honor of the public history program at Loyola University, where Victoria was set to graduate this coming fall. So we truly appreciate everyone's contribution to this fund through their presence here tonight.
So if you're new to Between Bites tonight, this is an event that combines food-inspired storytelling with philanthropy. We wanted to bring together people that love food, people that write about food, people that talk about food, people that make food and tell the stories that we sort of tell each other over dinner when we're eating together or drinks when we're kicking it. So we wanted to just bring that into a place where we can all share stories and share drinks and food. Every installment of Between Bites features a new venue, new writers, and a new theme. And this allows us to just showcase all the different talent in Chicago. Sorry. Okay, here's how tonight's gonna work. We're gonna have three readers tell a story that's related to food, and then we're gonna take a break. You guys can refill your drinks, grab some more food. Feel free to head outside. The sun will be going down. Hopefully it'll be nice and cool and lovely. We'll break for about 15 minutes or so, and then we'll come back and hear three more readers. Tonight's theme is Inside Outside, which was inspired by the beautiful weather and patio season and the literal inside outside of this gorgeous venue.
I thought you guys were raising your hands for us. I was like, yes, a question. Okay.
For our first reader, please welcome Samantha Landy. She is a very talented freelance food, kids, and lifestyle writer for Sometimes Splash, Time Out Chicago, Drive District, and Red Tricycle. She's also pregnant with her second baby and deserves bonus points for kicking off the night.
Yay!
And I'm probably the only one who has to read sober as well, so give me bonus points for that too. When I was 20, I did something absolutely insane. I boarded a bus with five peers and 30 hormonal 15-year-olds and hauled it from Michigan all the way out west in 43 days. And by haul it, I mean on a bus, a luxury coach, if you will, but the word luxury was dropped as soon as we put our backcountry gear on the bus. So yes, I signed up to spend over a month inside a glorified tube of raging hormones and stinky teenagers. But of course, at the time, it was the best thing to ever happen to me. I was going to be in charge of said teenagers, and I was going to see the Western United States in a way that most never get the opportunity to do. Of course, I likely also didn't consider that I would actually be in charge of finding our way through the backcountry with only a map, not a smartphone, that I'd be cooking my own food over a fire, and that I would be going to the bathroom in a hole. But we'll leave that part alone. So two things you should know about 20-year-old me. I was absolutely terrible with directions, and probably still am today. And I was kind of picky when it came to food. And then there was the staff. Between the six of us, we had one guy who looked eerily like Charles Manson, so clearly he could scare off the bears, and likely everyone else. Our supervisor, who I'm pretty sure made a secret vow to make sure that we showered less than once a week, a flower child who would keep us calm with her hippie vibes, the fun girl, and the nice boy who would probably lose out to the bear. Oh, and George, our bus driver, who we had to be extra nice to make sure that he would do really cool stuff for us, like take us to hit the Pizza Hut buffet for a special treat. And on this trip, the Pizza Hut buffet was an extra special treat. So before taking a trip like this, the staff heads up to a central camp to pack the bus. Supplies, food, whatever we could find. We were told to pack all of our dry goods for the trip as much as possible. Trail mix, granola, oatmeal, and also some perishables to get us to our first stop in Nebraska and possibly beyond until we could find a grocery store. It was only natural that we would house all the supplies under the bus, except for the kosher salamis. Some genius decided we should hang them meat locker style in the bathroom of the bus. PQM would be proud. Genius, it was actually served a dual purpose. Keep the salami safe and cool, and make sure that under no circumstances would anyone use the bathroom on the bus, or being inside the bus would no longer just smell like teenage boy BO in the mass of 43 unshowered people. It'd smell like, well, you get the idea. Once all packed, all we needed were the kids, who we picked up the following week. After that, we hit the road. There aren't a whole lot of glorious sights from Michigan to Nebraska, so we were anxious to progress through the hills of nothingness as quickly as possible, while we blasted Counting Crows Omaha, I'm pretty sure the only song that has ever been written about the state of Nebraska. Along the way, we divvied up responsibilities, and I chose to be in charge of meal planning. Secretly, I thought maybe I could control some of what we ate. Of course, I was in charge, but I was supposed to empower a camper volunteer to do most of the work. Guess there would be lots of gooey peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and slices of bathroom salami in my future. So the first real stop was the Dakotas. It was off to the infamous Wall Drugs in South Dakota, otherwise known as the Kingdom of Kitsch, where literally we bought mounds of crap, including the famous honk if you've ever been to Wall Drugs bumper sticker that is still proudly displayed on the bulletin board in my childhood bedroom. We also hiked the Badlands, and of course, who could forget Mount Rushmore? To this day, I have no vivid memories of the actual stone structure, but rather the best ice cream I've ever had in my life, Money Mint. Take this recommendation with a grain of salt, though. I'm pretty sure I was already starving. Next stop, Colorado. We had been on the bus for a week, so we were beginning to hit our stride as a group. It would also be our first major backcountry trip, hiking through the Rocky Mountains. Our supervisors assigned our trip pairings, and guess who I got paired with? Charles Manson. In one regard, I knew that I'd be safe as long as I didn't piss him off. He surely knew where he was going and what he was doing, right? I honestly was completely terrified, but just went with the flow. The good news was, at over 6 feet tall, he could hang our food high away from the bears, unlike me, who could barely reach the top shelf of my fridge. He could get us to where we needed to go with a compass and map, also good. But his body odor was so offensive, and trust me, at this point, I didn't smell good either, that I'm pretty sure no random animals would want to be near us. After getting us there, we set up camp, and he decided to sleep the entire day. Luckily, these kids knew what they were doing somewhat, and we pulled it together, built a fire, and cooked some amazing golden chocolate chip pancakes, a skill to this day that I have mastered. Just ask my 2-year-old. But the best thing that could have ever happened was have this lazy fool sleep. I now had the confidence that I could take control and do this. The Rocky Mountains were beautiful, glistening in the sun. And the real reward when we were done? A shower, finally, and a day trip to Aspen. I really can't remember much about Aspen either, except that being finally clean, all I wanted to do was walk in and out of all the fancy stores and spray perfume and sample different scents. Given it would probably be another 5 days till I showered, this may or may not have been the best idea, but it helped in the moment. From here on, it was amazing sight after amazing sight. Jackson Hole, Wyoming, another backcountry through the Tetons, Bryce Canyon, and then Zion, the ultimate test in hiking. After completing 2 backcountry trips, I didn't think that a national park hike would be the ultimate endurance test. If you don't know anything about the fluffy-sounding Angel's Landing, it is a 5-mile hike straight uphill. It is also smack in the middle of the hot, hot Utah sun, so starting any time later than 6 a.m. is completely preposterous. We got up at 4 a.m., packed up our campsite, and it was on. The first 2 miles were easy in comparison. They were switchbacks, but they were paved all the way up. After that, it's essentially just cliffs. There are some support chains, but by the time you reach the top of the mountain, you're completely exhausted. But once you get to the top, the sight is incredible. It's what defines beauty in the Western United States. An array of orange desert rocks staggered like dominoes in the distance with the hot sun beating across miles of desert. And although this wasn't the last stop on our trip, it remained one of my favorites. So after I caught my breath, I sat down and ate lunch, took in the sights, and you know what? It was the best damn bathroom salami sandwich I have ever had.
All right, way to go, Sam. Our next reader is a food multimedia guru. He runs the Sky Full of Bacon website, where he covers an insane amount of territory, writing posts on seemingly every restaurant in the city, big or small, and he features interviews on his podcast, Airwaves Full of Bacon. He's also doing incredible work over at the Chicago Reader, where he writes and also produces the Key Ingredient video series. He also contributes to Thrillist and was the Chicago editor of Grub Street Chicago and has also performed his work for Second Story. Please welcome Mike Gebbard.
That guy sounds cool. I got to meet him sometime. All right, so the name of my story is The Squeezonk of Tolerance. And warning, I sing in it. You can be on the outside of something and not know it until you find a way inside that you didn't know was there. That was how, one night many years ago, I finally found my way into Chicago, for which I have a long-gone Mexican nightclub to thank. I always had dreams of living in a big city. Specifically, I wanted to work in New York for Mad Magazine, like Don Martin, the guy who drew the grotesque people with the bulbous noses and the frizzy hair and the shoes that sort of bent up at 90 degrees and went squeezonk, squeezonk with every step. Instead, in time, I came to Chicago and went to work at an ad agency, which I think was doing pretty well, childhood ambition-wise. You know, give me a B+, come on. As far as I'm concerned, the main goal in life is just to avoid being the guy in the Bruce Springsteen song who works at the car wash in his small town and missed his dreams. And at night, he hears the shoes going squeezonk, but he'll never write for Mad Magazine. So, you know, I was happy to be here. But at the same time, I have to admit, it kind of terrified me. You kind of terrified me. I mean, I'd been to big cities with scary parts. I drank Campari in a dodgy bar in Munich when I was 16. I'd eaten barbecue at Arthur Bryan's in the ghetto in Kansas City. Okay, admittedly, Kansas City is one of those places where even the ghetto is kind of cute and charming. Oh, Marge, aren't these crack dens just quaint? But as soon as I got here, Chicago went out of its way to let me know that it was a scary place, a very consciously segregated place with lots of invisible lines you didn't want to cross. That was in the media, but it was also in the way that people talked about places like the South Side or Cabrini Green. I mean, I lived in an apartment in Buena Park up by Uptown once, and another real estate agent told me to call him later if I managed to survive visiting that area. This was a time so hung up on race that there was one restaurant, Valois Cafeteria down in Hyde Park, that was famous for the incredible fact that blacks and whites actually spoke to each other there. I mean, a guy from the UFC got an entire book out of that. So as much as I wanted to explore my new city, you also kind of freaked me out. I hugged the shoreline of Yuppieville because everyone was telling me that death awaited out there. I had very clear ideas of what every square on the map was about. Yuppies, guppies, drunken DePaul students, death. So this one night, my sister Jenny was staying with us at the time, as she tended to do, that is, move in with whoever she knew who had just moved somewhere interesting. And my friend Patrick, a producer for a video house I was doing some work with, suggested that we all go to a bar a few blocks away. I don't remember exactly what he said we were in for that evening. I only know he clearly did not tell me the truth about it. It turned out to be a Mexican bar called El Gato Negro. Okay, half the audience just guessed the punchline. on Irving Park, just west of Southport. This was well within the mental squares in my head that said Irving and Southport was a safe area, a gentrifying, modern area. We opened the door, and El Gato Negro was, it turned out, a rat hole. Painted in black because that meant you never had to clean it. A notion confirmed by how it smelled, too. Half the room had been arbitrarily designated as a stage, pretty theoretically. And there was a Mexican band there playing Mexican tunes while a few red-faced men sat at tables, already bleary-eyed enough that they looked like they might pass out for the evening while it was still technically afternoon. We order beers and chat among ourselves as the band finishes one song. Then I overhear the band leader say something about a song for Los Amigos Americanos, our American friends. Here we are, still in my Lakeview zip code, but we're the foreigners. You know, the friends from America. But to make us feel welcome, the band breaks into the one Mexican song that, of course, will be familiar and comforting to foreigners from that great faraway land of America. La 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 bamba. After that, they continue playing, and I see that the place has a number of, I don't even know what you call them now. In like an old 30s movie, you would have called them dime a dance girls. I don't know, is they even, no, I don't know. But it was Mexican women in tight black dresses dancing with these bleary-eyed Mexican working men who probably left their wives or girlfriends back home to make money in America. So for a little female companionship on Friday, they come here and pay to dance and cop a feel. The place fills up as this evening goes on. One of the dancing gals comes to sit and chat with us for a bit. Maybe we stood out a little, I'm just guessing. My sister Jenny, who worked as a waitress then, found an easy rapport with her. I was a little more awkward, like a million times more awkward. But part of being a writer is supposed to be being able to listen to people's stories. So we chat for a bit about the life she's living in America. At some point, she decides it would probably be good to actually do her job. So I get dragged out on the dance floor. It's not easy to dance to Mexican music while trying not to look at your friends laughing their asses off at you. The tallest, whitest thing on the dance floor. We must have looked like Salma Hayek dancing with Frosty the Snowman. Anyway, at one point she says, you know, a lot of the girls here are not ladies. I want to be gallant, so I say, oh, I wouldn't say that. I haven't seen them allow anything too untoward. No, she says, they are not ladies. And at last I get it. Not ladies as in, do look like a lady. As in, L-O-L-A-L-O-L-A. There are women with Adam's apples and shoulders for playing football all around me. Somehow, while I was sitting there, clueless as only a rube from Kansas could be, El Gato Negro had morphed into a transgender bar. And that night, I would have an experience that would change my outlook forever. No, not that kind. It isn't that kind of story about being in and coming out. But El Gato Negro helped shatter everything people had been telling me about how rigidly segregated and stratified Chicago was, into these neat little squares of semi-hostile identity. This bar was in Yuppieville, and yet it was Mexican, and yet it was transgender, and yet everybody was cool with that, and with us being there too. The city, which tried so hard to portray itself as divided into insiders and outsiders, into little Cold War zones of ethnicity, was in reality all mixed together. Far from being divided like a map of the Balkans, it was playing three-dimensional identity chess, because people wanted it that way. You know, in the words of the great scientist Jeff Goldblum, life finds a way. Wait, not done. And so in time, I stopped fearing Chicago. I found that I could pretty much go anywhere and do what I wanted to do, which was eat whatever they made there. And people would mostly think it was kind of great that I was interested in their food. I don't mean I'm stupid. It's still a big city with an appalling murder rate. And there are places I know better than to be at certain times of the day. But all in all, it's just a city with people in it, not tribes of enemies, not divided into one of us or stay out. El Gato Negro Strip is hipsterfied now. The space is a tattoo parlor, and a couple of doors down, you can get South Carolina fried chicken for hipsters at the Roost, and bubble tea at Joy E, and there's a Thai place and a Filipino social services office that used to be a Latino Alcoholics Anonymous, and so on. Which is to say, like so many blocks, it's Chicago in miniature, just as El Gato Negro kind of was in its very odd way. Most of all, it's my city, and I can walk down most any part of it. Squeeze-onk, squeeze-onk. What me worry?
Thank you so much, Mike. That was great. All right, so our next reader is the managing editor of Red Tricycle. She's been an editor at Daily Candy. She launched its Chicago Kids edition and wrote the Weekend Guide. She has twin kindergarten-age boys and loves music, dance, and anything that has to do with the 80s, specifically boombox confetti. Please welcome Kelly Eglon.
Hi, everybody. My story is about the bar that my grandma used to own in Wisconsin. There is a neon Bud Light sign hanging in my parents' basement, and it is amazing. The Bud glows red, the light glows blue. When lit, it buzzes faintly, just enough to keep you company. The rust on its metal frame makes it look tough, legit. If it could talk, it would say, "Yeah, I've been there." And it has. The sign first hung in the bar my grandma used to own, Curtin's Tap. Curtin's Tap was a genuine dive in a genuine working class town, Cudahy, Wisconsin. The city of Cudahy, in case you aren't familiar, is on Milwaukee's south side and is known for its bacon factory, Patrick Cudahy. It's small-time America, but instead of the kind with white picket fences and ice cream shops, it has cracked sidewalks and insurance agencies with houseplants in the windows. It's blue-collar, but the people have pride. The city has soul. You can make fun of it, but you don't want to mess with it. You could say that Cudahy is what would happen if Cicero and Summit had a baby and a Green Bay Packer was the godfather. My dad's parents owned Curtin's Tap from 1940 until 1985, and the whole family, my grandma, grandpa, dad, and his brother lived above it. I visited often during the last 10 years it was open. Some kids would go over the river and through the woods to visit grandmother's house. I went to a dive bar. On weekends, my parents and I would drop by. The bar sat on the corner of two residential streets, one block from the main street, and within stumbling distance from the police station. We'd roll up to the plain vinyl-sided building. I remember its windows that, even during the day, were covered by thick velvet red curtains, the kind that you would imagine would go down at the end of an illicit vaudeville show, just as the applause was phasing. I didn't realize at the time that all of this was something special, a picture of bars past, a moment in time that should be savored, but would be forgotten. Nobody Facebooking, tweeting, or Instagramming. We don't even have pictures. But if I were on Twitter back then at age 8, I would have tweeted something like, "Going to grandma's house, Shirley Temple and crispy pork rinds get in my belly. Hashtag hangry." Nobody was surprised to see a little girl with pigtails and a unicorn shirt walk in. The regulars knew me. I would plop on a bar stool like I owned the place. The bar ran the length of the entire wall, and my grandma was always behind it, Marlboro between shaky fingers and shocks of white hair shooting out in every direction, an elder's afro. The stools were black plastic, hard and leathery, words that could also describe the faces of the bar patrons sitting around me. If it were close to noon, there would be factory workers on break having a liquid lunch. At that time of day, it was beer. Pabst, Schlitz, Blatz. This was Milwaukee, after all. Pints were cheap and affordable for the factory workers. Along with Patrick Cudahy, the other factory in town was Lavish, an industrial business that made steel rings used in submarines. It was all good, honest work, and the workers, despite their tough demeanors, were pleasant and chatty. If it were the end of the day, the seats would be filled with the happy hour crowd, office workers who waited for 5 p.m. before cutting loose. At that time of day, people switched from beer to cocktails, martinis, Manhattans, and old fashions. The spirit was swinging, the vibe celebratory. Think Mad Men,
if John Hem wore a bowling shirt and had a handlebar mustache. At any point in the day, you had the regulars, and they were like family. There was one in particular, Uncle Frank. He wasn't my uncle or my dad's uncle. He was a neighbor who worked in the post office. Uncle Frank always dressed the same. He had a long sleeve button down, a sports coat, and black shiny dress shoes. He wore this day in and day out, day after day. And I knew, even at a young age, that he was a character. He was always super friendly, smiling, and spewing baseball factoids. Uncle Frank had been a huge Milwaukee Brewers fan, and in my Milwaukee Braves fan, and in my time, a Brewers fan. I would listen patiently, but without much interest. These were the early years, before they were racing sausages to capture kids' hearts, and you actually had to root for the players. The one thing I remember about Uncle Frank was the fact that he was a cheapskate. His frugality can be summed up with one anecdote. He once told my grandma that to save money on electricity, he had tied a string from his bedpost to his bathroom doorknob. That way, if he had to get up to pee in the middle of the night, he could guide himself to the toilet by following the string, and he didn't have to turn any lights on. I always hoped that Uncle Frank had good aim. When there weren't people to look at and talk to in the bar, I would mill around making my own fun. The room was sparsely decorated. There were just a few tables and a back section that had a pool table and a pinball machine. The games cost just 10 cents. 10 cents! Which is amazing considering that to play one skee ball game at Slippery Slope in Logan Square, you have to pay a dollar. I'm pretty sure that if Billy Bob from Showbiz Pizza had gotten wind of this, he is turning in his grave. If there were a big game on, I would gather around the TV and listen to my grandma get riled up with the patrons. But to me, sports were boring, so I waited for the game to end so I could play the huge jukebox in the corner. For 5 cents, you got your pick of songs. 5 cents. This was before I began collecting my own records and took what I could get. There, in Curtin's Tap, it was polkas. I would dance to Beer Barrel Polka, shuffling along the speckled tile floor, shaking my arms around wildly, because though that's not a real polka move, that's how a 7-year-old spaz dances. Sometimes when I was busting a move, my grandma would pass me a Slim Jim. It was a token treat. Bars at that time didn't offer much to eat, and a small plates menu would have been as foreign as E.T. using a speak and spell. Still, my grandma was savvy about munchies and kept a small selection of bags for sale. Slim Jims, pork rinds, pretzel rods, and chips mainly. And you could also find the gold standard of bar fare at that time, pickled pig's feet. They had their own revered place in a glass jar in the back bar. Sometimes the same food vendor that supplied the pig's feet also supplied pickled eggs, and those were a legend unto themselves. When I think back to the whole spirit of the place, the laughter, the stories, the nickel jukebox, I feel happiness and a small pull of sadness. I ache to remember more about the bar, those times. There are no photos, my Google searches for Curtin's Tap come up dry, and there's definitely no hashtag to search, although polka pig's feet seems fitting. My grandma died in 1985 and I was 10 years old. We got a call from Uncle Frank late one morning and he said the bar hadn't opened yet. And for a bar that opened every day of the year at 9 a.m. like clockwork, that just didn't seem right. Turns out my grandmother had had a heart attack in her sleep right upstairs. But it was quiet, painless, and I like to think that she left this world surrounded by the things she loved, and maybe a few Slim Jims. My dad and his brother sold the bar and the apartment upstairs with it. The man they sold it to kept it as a bar. He renamed it the Surf 2, and it did a solid business for a few years before customers just trickled away. After the Surf 2 closed, its owner sold it to someone who turned it into a regular old house. I drive past the house today, and outside, creeping by the front windows, which once held the secrets behind the thick velvet curtains, I imagine the place it once was. I wonder who lives there now, if there's a sofa where the jukebox used to be, if the bar is still standing, if the Brewers are playing on TV, if the owner has a taste for pickled pig's feet. And I wonder if, possibly, maybe if, the new owner's world would be just a little bit brighter if there were a neon Bud Light sign buzzing inside.
Thank you. Thank you.
for the three leaders. Awesome. All right. So we're going to take about a 15-minute break. If you guys want to help yourselves some more food, go out and enjoy the patio. Maybe it's cooled off a little bit with some drinks and wine, and we will reconvene with three more readers. Thank you.